Tonight we're going to look at the man David, and we will look at him again next week. Tonight we're going to look at a man of weakness, and next week we will look at a man of strength. David has a great comparison there as you look at both sides of his life. You know, for all his strengths, though, even as the man of God, he is a man probably more famous for his weaknesses than he is for the strength that he had. You know, there are two primary weaknesses that as we think about David, I think we see. And I think all of us can relate to these two weaknesses in our own lives at different times. And that is, one is rashness and the other is pride. And David had many a struggle because of those two things in his life. I had a couple of examples here to go into, but even as I was coming to church, I even thought of another one. And I want to mention it real quick as we begin the lesson. But rashness, you know, David failed to think through what he was going to do. I know there's been many a times that I failed to think through what I was going to do. You know, I said things before I thought about what the consequences on the other side of that statement were going to be. I think we all understand that if you've lived very long, you have been rash at some point. And then, you know, as we think about pride, he did things that were really just about him. And protecting him or giving him something that he may have wanted. And I think we see him even doing this even before he is king, when he is out in the wilderness with his army, and he comes to Nabal, the Carmelite. And Nabal is not a very nice man. And David has been protecting his shepherds, protecting his sheep. In fact, his shepherds have not lost a single sheep the entire time that David was protecting them. In fact, the shepherds would say that David had put a wall around them, right? And so David simply asked for him to give him some aid. And Nabal is very hateful toward David. And David, in a kind of a rash moment, you know, just decides that that's it for Nabal. And he tells the men to strap on the swords. He's going to kill every male that is in Nabal's house. And if it wasn't for the intervention of Abigail and cooler minds prevailing, thankfully for her, she kept David from doing this and would eventually go on after Nabal's death to be David's wife. Well, I think there's two bigger ones that we can think of. I think everybody here knows at least one of the big ones. It's the one he's most famous for. When we think about the rashness and pride of David, but I want us to think about his rashness and his pride when it came to moving the Ark of the Covenant. We always just assign that story to the death of Uzzah, but yet David is at the heart of that story. And when we look at that in 2 Samuel chapter 6, the Ark had been at the residence of a man named Abinadab for 70 years. Imagine that. No one has gone to get it. I think that's a commentary on what has happened to the children of Israel, that the Ark of the Covenant has been returned by the Philistines, but yet has set at a man's house for 70 years. If you remember, the Philistines took the Ark when they killed Eli's sons. They took the Ark down to their cities, and it didn't go so well for them, did it? You can have the Ark, but the Ark has to want to be where it's at. And they put it in front of Dagon, their god, and over a couple of nights, it ended up with Dagon on the ground with no legs, no hands, and basically destroyed. Then they took it to another city, and they all developed sores. They all became sick. People died. And the Philistines said, "We don't want this anymore." And so they carried it back. And it sits at Abinadab's house for 70 years. And then David then decided that he wanted to bring it to his new capital city of Jerusalem. Now, David sent his men to retrieve it. Now, Uzzah is one of Abinadab's sons. He is one of the sons that lives in the house of where the ark has been kept for all these years. Now, the ark was supposed to be carried a particular way. And if David had really been about God in this particular situation, it even seems that there's pride involved in wanting to bring it back to Jerusalem, because he hasn't really thought about what God said in regard to how the Ark of the Covenant is to be carried. The Ark of the Covenant was to be carried on the shoulders of the Kohathites. Numbers chapter 14 and verse 15. The Kohathites were the descendants of one of the sons of Levi. Aaron and Moses were both Kohathites. And so that those were the men that were supposed to carry it. By God's decree, they were to carry it on their shoulders. And each of the descendants, if we look back to Levi even, each of the descendants of the three sons had specific responsibilities as it regarded the tabernacle of God. Levi's three sons and their descendants had specific roles that they were to carry out as those people that were in charge of the tabernacle and the worship of God. The Gershonites, they tended to the tent of the tabernacle. Now that certainly became a different job whenever he got the temple. But they tended to the tent. They, when the tent was moved, they were the ones that took it down, took it apart, carried it, put it back together, and it all, you know, so that worship could begin again. The Kohathites, they dealt with the furnishings. That would include the Ark of the Covenant and all the other furnishings that were in the tabernacle. And they were also the priestly line. They were the ones that were in charge of the services. And so they carried out that role. And then the Merarites, they were in charge as well of the framing for the temple, not just or the tabernacle, not just the cloth that covered it or the canvas that covered it, but the framing itself. So they're kind of the carpenters, I guess you could say, of the tabernacle. So these three lineages from Levi had their roles. And it should have been considered. David should have considered that when he sent them down to get the Ark of the Covenant. But he did not bother to think about those details. And then we all know the story that they put it on the new cart. It got upset. Uzzah reached up, grabbed it, and died. Which was God's law. You don't touch the Ark. And there's no exceptions to that. And so he touched the Ark and he died. David doesn't get upset at himself. He doesn't say, you know, I should have done it right. I should have. No, he gets mad at God. He becomes angry with God. Why did God do this? And there we kind of see the pride, don't we? I'm king. I'm David. Why in the world did you mess up my great plan to bring this triumphant return of the Ark back to Jerusalem? You messed it up, God. So he becomes angry in verse 8. He placed it then in the house. They didn't even bring the Ark back. Even after this happened, they just decided, okay, they're kind of like the Philistines. We don't want it either. And so they stop and they leave it at a man's house named Obed-Edom, the Gittite. And all the time that it's at Obed-Edom's house, his house is blessed. I mean, everything works for him, you know. He's taking care of the Ark and God is blessing his house. And then it seems like that gets back to David. And David goes, hey, I want some of that. You know, I want that in my house. I want things to be going good for me like it is for him. And when he was told about that blessing after three months, he once again sent them to retrieve the Ark, maybe still because of pride, maybe still for this purpose of wanting it for himself, but he sends them, but this time, he does it right. He sends the right men to carry it the right way to bring it back. So we see David acting rashly even early on in regards to the Ark of the Covenant. Another one certainly that we could look at, another instance in his life is the rashness and pride that we see in the sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. You know, David goes up on the roof of his house and he sees a woman on the roof of another house bathing. And David gives in to the lust that is in his heart and he commits adultery with her. He sins for her, has her come. See, this was a very rash moment, wasn't it? He saw her, sent for her, committed adultery with her. Just that quick. And he didn't think his options. You know, we don't lose control. We just don't always exercise good judgment, do we? We don't always take the moments and the times to think about whether or not we should do these things. Then David understands and knows that he has to cover this up because what happens with Bathsheba? She gets pregnant. And it's going to be hard to cover this up because her husband isn't even at home. He's out fighting in the field in the Lord's army of Israel. So he calls him back, and David's pride begins the effort to cover up. And he sounds so magnanimous. It's hard to look at David like this. But he sounds so magnanimous when he tells Uriah, you go home and see your wife, right? I'm such a good king. But see, Uriah had something David didn't, at least not at this moment. Uriah was a man of honor. You know, it wasn't, he kills this man because this man is honorable. That's what gets Uriah killed. Uriah says, how can I go home and to my wife and sleep in my bed at home when the other soldiers are out in the field? I can't do that. So he sleeps on the doorstep. So David's plan doesn't work. And so David orders Joab and literally sends the orders. I mean, you know, there are things that you just look at and you consider, you look at the person, you say, how could you have done something so heinous and evil? But he writes the orders to have Uriah killed, have him put on the front line to ensure that he would be killed. And he hands those orders to Uriah to deliver to Joab on the battlefield. There's a coldness there in David that this rashness and his pride has brought out. You know, as great a man as David was, in the moment, without thinking, and only thinking about the repercussions for himself and his life, he let murder in his life. And from that day forward, David did not know peace ever again. We look at the punishments that are brought down. And David, you know, when we think about Nathan coming to David and giving him the story about the little lamb and the family, you know, it's a story that makes you ill, right? How dare you? And David was. He was mad. You tell me who this is. You are the man, David. You took, when you had all you could want, you took somebody else's possession. And God pronounced punishments on David as a result of his sin, even though he was forgiven. His son, Bathsheba, would die. He would not have that child. Few pains worse than the loss of one's child. And David understood that one. Solomon would be another son that would be born to Bathsheba. Actually, the mother of Solomon was Bathsheba, and so she would be the mother of the next king, but not that first son. And also God said that the sword would not depart from his house. And you begin to look, and you know, we think about family difficulties. Problems that we have in our families, right? And those are some of the most difficult problems we have, right? When we're dealing with our family, whether it's our immediate family or extended family, those are tough problems. Because family just kind of feels like, well, you got to love me, we're family, we're blood, I can say whatever I want to you, right? And sometimes it gets a little ugly. But listen to the problems that David had in his family as a result of a moment of rashness and acting on pride. And I remind you that David didn't come around easy. It was a year later before David was confronted by Nathan, and he had just continued the cover-up for that entire time. Well, the sword would not depart from his house. Let's think about what happened. Amnon raped his half-sister Tamar. Absalom kills Amnon because of the sin, 2 Samuel 13. Absalom then rebels against David, literally puts him on the run from him as he tries to usurp the throne of Israel. Adonijah conspires as well to take the throne. These are all sons and family members. This is what's taking place in his family. And these were consequences that came onto David's life as a result of a moment's bad decision. You know, there would be open immoralities as well, God said, within his family. And see, when Absalom ran David out of Jerusalem, he went up onto the roof and he raped all of his father's wives and concubines in the front of all of Israel to bring shame and dishonor on his father. Those are the things David faced as a result of not thinking through his actions. We go on to toward the end of his life. You know, you think, well, David reached the point he got it, right? No, he goes all the way down to the end of his life, and the old rash and pride issue pops up again for him. He shows great rashness and pride by taking a forbidden census. Exodus chapter 30 and verse 12 states that if a census is taken of the people, that there was to be ransom paid by each individual counted, or there would be a plague. Not a lot of ifs, ands, or buts about that one. Don't do it. But there's no indication at all, and certainly from the consequences that were brought down upon Israel, it's clear he didn't. He did not collect this ransom when he ordered the census to be taken. Pride appears to be his motivation. Pride appears to be the reason why he wanted to see what his manpower was so he could boast. I have this many men. I have this many soldiers at my disposal to be able, as king, to push out his chest and to speak with great pride about those things. Verse 2, he says, count the people that I may know their numbers. After 9 months and 20 days, I love Joab. Joab said, please don't do this, David. I mean, it isn't like he's not getting counsel here. He said, don't do this. And David said, no, do it. Listen to me, do what I say. But after 9 months and 20 days, rather, Joab finally gives David the count because Joab will not count them. Joab keeps counting part of them, but he won't count all of them because the Bible literally says that he found the command to be abhorrent. And so Joab wouldn't do it. He came back to David to give him the count. He didn't count the Levites. He didn't count the Benjamites. So he didn't count them all. So I guess he's trying to get off on a technicality. Well, you know, I didn't take the whole census. I just took part. It'd be sort of like, you know, the United States taking the census and not bothering to count Nevada and Montana, right? For whatever reason. So he left that out. But finally he gave David the count in 1 Chronicles 21. And he is told, David's told that he has 800,000 valiant men, soldiers, men of army age under his command, and 500,000 men in Judah that he can command. You know, David, it's amazing to me, and I think we can understand this in our lives, that there are times when we commit sins and we think it's going to be really great to do it, right? It's something we really want. And the minute it happens, I mean the very minute it happens, it doesn't fulfill the expectation, right? And we're immediately filled with guilt. Why in the world did I just do that? I think we understand that. I think everybody has gone through that. And that is exactly what happens to David. For almost immediately upon receiving the number, whatever satisfaction he thought he was going to get, he didn't. And he immediately realized his error and was sorry for what he had done, but his rashness and his pride had already pushed him beyond the point of turning back. You know, God gives him three choices. And I've often compared this to my mother making me go out and pick my switch. That's just, I mean, I really think that's one of the cruelest things. That's cruel and unusual. I mean, it's all right to switch your child, but don't make them go pick it. That's pushing it over the line. Because, you know, there's a lot of conflict there. If I get one too big, it's going to bruise. If I get one too skinny, oh, it's going to sting. If I get one that's nearly broken, she's going to go get it herself, and I'm going to get more, right? It's a terrible time in your life to stand before the bush, looking at the limbs, thinking, maybe if I leave the leaves on it, it won't hurt so bad, right? But she will never let that get by. So David kind of gets the same thing. David, I'm going to give you three choices. And folks, quite frankly, none of them are very good. You know, none of them are really what you would want. He gives him a choice of 3 years of famine, 3 months of being swept away before his enemies, and 3 days of plague. Well, David had just endured a long famine. He didn't want no more of that. David had nearly been killed in recent battles. In fact, his men had had to make him promise that he would no longer go onto the battlefield, lest the light of Israel be extinguished. And so he's been defeated in battles, so he doesn't want any more of that. And so he goes with the 3 days of plague. Being the trust, he says, in the mercy of God. He says, I'm gonna pick the plague and I'm gonna believe in the mercy of God. That mercy of God that Jonah understood. You know, when he went to Nineveh, he said, I knew if I told them and they repented, you wouldn't destroy them. That mercy, that's what David's looking for. That God in His kindness and His gentleness and His love would give a reprieve to the penalty. Well, before that mercy would be shown, though, 70,000 Israelites would die. And an angel was coming up on the city of Jerusalem to smite the city and David. And at the threshing floor of Moriah, David offered a sacrifice that brought the plague to an end. God's mercy was extended in the end. You know, that's that wonderful text where the man offered the threshing floor for free and David said, I won't take it for free. I will pay you for it because I will never bring anything to God that costs me nothing. See, everything we give to God is about sacrifice. God doesn't want our what's cheap. He wants what costs. You know, it's an interesting thing, too, when we consider that the place where he offered that sacrifice that saved the city of Jerusalem and that ended God's plague and brought God's mercy to the people is the very same place that his son would build the temple just a few short years later. It would be built upon that spot. So he offers a sacrifice in the place where sacrifices would be offered for many hundreds of years after his death. You know, we are often guilty of rashness and pride. Like David, others suffer for our weakness in these areas. Think of the people that suffered because of David. And because he didn't think. And because he didn't care about others more than he cared about himself. People like Uzzah. People like Bathsheba. And you know, we think, well, she married a king, yeah, but she lost a husband. And she lost a child as a result of his actions. Uriah, an honorable man. Not only just an honorable man, but he was one of David's mighty men. David killed one of his most faithful men, the ones that are listed as his mighty men. He was in that. All that were lost in the violence that ensued in his family as a consequence during Absalom's rebellion and Adonijah's. All those people that died in the wars there that followed. The 70,000 people in the plague. And let me tell you what, folks. If we do not exercise self-control, if we do not exercise a moment of judgment in our lives before we just jump out and do something, if we do not care about other people more than we care about ourselves, we will hurt people all around us. Just as David did. We will bring heartache and pain. How many people today do not have family members because somebody felt like getting drunk and driving a car was more important than other people on the road? How many people have lost family members because someone thought taking drugs was the most important thing in their lives and ended up hurting somebody as a result? So many things in our lives that hurt others. And even if we don't talk about death, we hurt others emotionally as well. But David also, you know, not only if we act like David will we hurt others, but we will ultimately, like David, hurt ourselves too. David hurt himself. You know, from 2 Samuel 2 to 2 Samuel 12, David reigned in triumph. Everything was good. He was blessed. Everything was going great. And everything from chapter 13 to 1 Kings chapter 2 is tragedy. That's what sin does to your life. That's why God says don't do it. There's a reason that God says certain things do not need to be in our lives because He understands what they do to our lives and what they do to the lives of those we love and we care about and people we don't even know. And last of all, not only will you hurt others and hurt yourself, but this is the one that should bother you the most. You know, when I hurt myself and my own sins, I need to say, I deserve that. I got what was coming to me for my actions. This is the one that should bother me. Is that I hurt God. I hurt Jesus Christ. That's what my sins do. I think we sometimes forget what our sins do to God. Because every hammer hit on those nails in Jesus' hands and in His feet, and every strike on His back, and every mocking upon the cross, and every step He took to Golgotha was because I was stupid. Because I was rash. Because I thought more of me than I did of Him. We need to remember that. Sin is not just about what it does to me and what it does to the people around me. It is about what it does to God and how it hurts Him. It has to hurt Him to be willing to go through the pain that He went through to do something about it. See, I won't do anything about a tooth because I hate dentists. I know I don't have any dentists here, so I can say that a lot easier. I've had some in other places. I don't hate them personally. I just hate their profession. I can't stand dentists. And I'll be honest with you, I have to believe that I'm hurting worse than he's going to hurt me. You got to believe that the pain on the cross is not as bad as the pain of sin to God. Because he wanted to do something about that. And he was willing to go through that to do it, to get to the joy that lay before him. That's what sin does. That's why the one cry on the cross in agony is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? When Jesus became sin for all of us, when sin came upon him, that was the greatest agony at Golgotha. We need to remember that. See, David was greatly distressed. You read Psalm 51, and you'll see and understand that David understood what he did to God, right? Against you, and you only, have I sinned. And my sin is ever before me. It won't go away. I can't get rid of it. My guilt is great because of what I've done to you, God. Not because of what I did to Uriah. Not because of what I did to all those other people. What I did to you. Oh, create in me a clean heart that I don't do that to you again. We need to remember God when we are thinking about how we're going to act and what we're going to do. Have you ever thought about what David could have been without his weaknesses? What a man he would have been. What a king he would have been. Oh, what he could have been if he'd have just taken the moment to think, to exercise good judgment, and considered others before himself. What can we be for God if we work harder to seek to overcome the same difficulties in our lives, the same failings in our lives, that we might truly be the people of God? Just as David was a man after God's own heart, may we too endeavor to be that. Next week we'll look at his strengths, because it is his strengths. You know, everybody has weaknesses, and if you say you don't, then you're lying. And if you only have one, you're indeed blessed. But everybody has weaknesses. I do. You do. We all struggle with them. But it is, what is our strengths, and are our strengths those strengths that are able to help us overcome those weaknesses? Because while David had incredible weaknesses, he had a greater strength. He had a strength that was greater than his weaknesses, and that strength was firmly grounded in one place, in God. That made all the difference. You read Psalm 51, you see it. He understands what he's got to do. He understands where he's got to go. He understands that something's got to change. He's not living in denial anymore. He says, I've sinned, and God, forgive me. This evening, if you are in that condition, that you have allowed your weaknesses and whatever they may be, if you've allowed your weaknesses to take you into sin, come back to God. Have the strength to say, God, I have sinned. To understand that, yes, you are the man in whatever the situation is, and that you want him to create in you a clean heart, one that is free and pure because sin has been removed through the forgiveness of Jesus Christ. If you're a child of God, you can pray to God, confess those sins, repent of those sins, and know that he's faithful and just to forgive you. If you're not a Christian, Jesus Christ died for you, so that you do not have to carry those sins into an eternity of lostness. You can obey the gospel tonight. You can believe in Jesus Christ, repent of your sins, confess him as the Son of God, and be buried in baptism, having your sins washed away there, never to come back, to rise, to walk a life of strength. Strength that is strong enough to overcome all your weaknesses because it is a strength grounded in God. If we can assist you in any way in that endeavor this evening, we hope and pray that you will let us as we stand and as we sing.